Welcome to the Radio Book Club here at Community Radio KGNU Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. It's a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran and my co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian, who is the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore. And this month we've been reading one of my favourite things to read, short stories. Arsene, tell us about this month's selection.
Well, short stories are one of my favorite things, too. So we read Awayland by Ramona Ossebel, and it's a collection of short stories. They're not linked, per se, but there are definitely some themes that the stories have in common that we'll get into. But it's a really eclectic, strange, and wonderful collection.
We're delighted to have Ramona Ossebel join us in the studio. Hello, thank you for coming in.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It really is a wonderful collection, and there's so much mythology and magical realism and all kinds of exciting stuff to delve into here. But the title of the book, Awayland, it really does, I think, capture what you're capturing in so many of the stories, because there are so many different locations. We go from Beirut to Egypt to California, Turkey, and then some unnamed locations as well that we can only imagine. Was this what you were trying to capture to bring us on a geographic tour of the globe?
Yes, absolutely. I had this feeling of, I didn't move long distances, but I hadn't lived in the same place since I was 17 years old. And I'd moved every between 1 and 3 years for the second half of my life. And I had this sort of constant feeling of longing for all those places that I had, that I felt like were sort of part of me, but I didn't know what my relationship was. So I started writing toward that idea of home and away, and what it was to be at a distance from the place where you began or the place that you wanted to be, and also some kind of place within yourself. So there was an awayness in the physical world and in the emotional world too.
But I mentioned some of the places that you cover in the book. Had you personally been to any of them? Beirut looms large. Was that somewhere you have a connection to?
I have been to Beirut for like a few days, but I don't have any in my biography. There's no connection otherwise. I had, when I finished graduate school, I was given a small fellowship, and I decided I would use that to travel around the world. So I convinced my husband to quit his job, which is what you do when you have a few $1,000s, right? And we traveled for about 9 months. We started in Morocco, and we went across Eastern Europe and then through the Middle East and East Africa and India and then Asia, and came home from Mongolia. And I was writing, at first I thought I was going to write some essays, but quickly I realized that that's not what my heart was wanting. So when we came home, I started writing these weird stories, and I realized that all of the experiences of that trip and all of the interviews that I've been doing for the essays were going to turn into these strange short stories. So many of the places in the book are from that trip.
You say strange. I find them wonderful.
Oh, good.
Strange insofar as you write from different perspectives, whether it's a mummified cat in a museum in Egypt, or the perspective of a cyclops, or the perspective of a daughter of a mother who's dying. So you inhabited all of those characters wonderfully.
Thank you. I think that strange and wonderful for me are like tied together. Yeah. I always like things more when they're weirder.
I would agree with that too. You know, water plays such a big part. These places are all places with water. There's a lot of islands. There's the coast, Beirut, the water's right there. So the water plays such a big role, not only as a landscape feature, but it interacts with the characters in a very deeply personal way often.
Yeah, I was just talking to a student about that. She was asking me that question, and I was trying to figure out. She was saying, I write about water because I live on an island and I grew up on an island. And I thought, well, that's not why I write about water, because I grew up in the desert. I grew up in New Mexico. And maybe that's what it is for me, is that I moved to California when I was 17. And I think that the sudden presence of water all around me was really profound, and both a little bit scary. The ocean is so forceful, and you can, you know, you disappear in it. There's no, the ocean doesn't register your little body. Right. So but it's beautiful too.
Well, you have a story where somebody disappears in the ocean.
Yeah.
You've got drowning daughters, dissolving mothers, where somebody dissolves into water basically, and also a shipwreck. So these are really harrowing encounters with water that you play with in these stories.
Right. The water is dangerous, but also there's some sort of hope or grace in the water at the same time. Usually, not always.
And the water can cough up surprising things, you know, like a mermaid.
Yes, but not a lovely mermaid like you'd imagine, a sort of dying, gross old lady mermaid.
But the people who find her lovely.
Exactly.
I suppose they're imposing their own fantasies or longings, maybe.
Right. She is what they want to see in her. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that where the characters are imposing their needs, their longings onto, in that case, the mermaid. But in other stories, too, there's this kind of seeing what you need to see or something, you know, this needing things to be. And what I like is your stories, as Maeve said, have some magic to them, the best magical realism. So some things can come true, even though it seems like what they want or is absurd.
Right, right. But I think that's part of what I was thinking about, too, with the idea of travel and the idea of being in a place that's foreign to you, is that you have to see yourself in a new way. But you also begin right away to impose a story from your own life and your own mind onto this new place, and you start noticing the details that you want to see. So it was part of writing about that too, of the way that we narrate things that are outside of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first story that totally grabbed my attention was the very first story, and it's written from the perspective of a cyclops, but he's trying to create an online dating profile. And I thought, what a wonderful mix of ancient history and fables with modern reality.
That was a really fun story to write. At first it was just sort of a joke. I was like, what if a cyclops filled out an online dating profile? But I knew that if I was going to become a short story, it was going to have to go beyond the joke, and it was going to have to really be a heartbreak of a story, that he was going to be a person who couldn't, or a creature, I guess, who truly wanted that kind of love and knew that it was maybe impossible for him to get it. So the tension between the voice of the instructor trying to help him through this profile and how to write it for success, and then his own ache within that, felt like that was the tension is those two things next to each other.
Well, it's interesting you talked about, you know, wanting to be more than just kind of this humorous piece, because when I read it in the New Yorker originally, and I thought, this is kind of like a longer, better Shouts and Murmurs piece, which is kind of their one page humor right. pieces. But it didn't seem that far off. It seemed like somewhere between, you know, what they usually publish as stories, which are usually quite serious for the New Yorker, not always, but often. And the Shouts and Murmurs, which are often goofy essays. And it right. seemed somewhere to be spoofing, almost seemed like it was spoofing the spoof in a way. Like, yeah, you'd think you get a Shouts and Murmurs of somebody trying to put together an online dating thing, and now you've got a cyclops putting it together.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that I know. I was surprised that was the story that they wanted. It's always interesting to imagine what somebody might want, any audience, and then to be surprised by the thing that people really are moved by.
So in that story, I thought you did set off a major theme in the book. And the very first line of that story and in the book is, you are lonely, but you don't have to be. Loneliness drives a lot of these characters, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Whatever it is they're searching for, whether it's home or love or a definition of their own story, like the one that you mentioned, Maeve, with the animal mummies in the Egypt Museum, they are trying to retell their own story because their story has been told for them by humans for thousands of years. And now they're ready to say, actually, we have some notes on that. So sometimes it's just reclaiming your own history that people are longing for. But yeah, loneliness and the wish to fill that loneliness with something, I think, is probably in every story in the book.
Yeah, you certainly feel. One story that I really enjoyed was Club Zeus. And this is a teenage boy who is trying to escape from California by rowboat, basically, after his parents' marriage has fallen apart. And he has a very close relationship with his mother, but now his mother has become spiritual. And the solution to this is to send the boy to a friend's aunt's, you know, in Turkey, where he's working at Club Zeus. So maybe you could describe, what is Club Zeus exactly?
So Club Zeus in this story is a resort, a summertime resort on the Turkish coast, full of all of the, you know, ridiculous many swimming pools with lots of statues in them. And they're all Greek statues because it's a Greek themed resort. But they're the idea of Greek statues. So they have, you know, big bosoms, and it's all very silly. And this boy, the summer job that he has is to be the storyteller in the story tent. So he has to put on a fake beard and a big robe, and he sits in this story tent and he tells Greek myths to the drunk or sunburned or tired. Sometimes the clients just come in and nap the whole time. And that is his job, and he doesn't interact with anybody else. And most of the hotel's guests are Ukrainian, so he doesn't even really understand what's going on around him.
Right. And he's staying with the woman, this aunt, and they overlook a cemetery which is between them and the sea. And so you have this kind of death pervades some of the story, and until there is somebody floating in a pool.
Right.
And he has a pretty strong reaction to this. And I wonder if you could read a little bit about, you know, when he sees this dead body, and he has to stay because the police say everybody's got to stay. We have to question everybody on why is there a dead body in the pool. And so he decides he's going to call home. And I thought maybe you could read that just to give our listeners a feel for your writing and your voice.
Absolutely. And he's calling his mother, who has not been terribly receptive to his needs in the last few years. Although she has gotten him here. She's both sort of receptive and not at all. So you'll hear some of that. Mom, I say, as if I am prompting her to be that person. Oh, hi, sweetheart. When I tell her about the fat man, there is a thick silence. I hope the story hurts her. I want her to share what I am feeling because my pain is part of her job. Love, she says. Oh, love. But she sounds proud of me, as though she is congratulating me for an achievement, for achieving a long-held goal. I try again to capture her, to drag her into my sadness. I say, he was just floating there. His dead body was just floating there. There is a pause, and I think I may have succeeded. Then she tells me, my friend Ashtar was over today, and he saw that picture of you when you were 5 with the tractor. He said you have an old soul. You are stronger than you know. What she means is that I am on my own. What she means is that tragedy is also currency, that enlightenment depends on grief, that love grows in soil that has been tilled. For a moment, I wonder if she planned this whole thing, if she prayed to all her gods, not for my safety or for my happiness, but for me to be deepened, opened, undone, so that I might begin to blossom into my truest self.
That's author Ramona Asabout reading from Camp Zeus, which is one of the short stories in her new collection, Awayland Stories. And she is our guest this month of June on the Radio Book Club. And we're delighted to have her in studio. And we talked about the different themes in the book. You've got water, mothers and parents. That really jumped out at me. This idea that our relationship with our parent, particularly mothers. There's one of the stories is that the mother who basically dissolves into mist as she's dying and the daughter's reaction to that. Then another daughter of that mother appears in a different story and then she's pregnant. And so we have that concept as well. Was this a theme that you really wanted to explore?
Absolutely. I had children during the course of the writing of these stories. And so some of it was just this sort of pushing into the question of what it is to know that you will love somebody that you've just met and didn't exist before right now, and you know that you will love them for the rest of your life, and that you will have to fight through all kinds of terrible things, and the terrible things could happen to that little person, but then also to then look back at my parents and think about now understanding, seeing that I'm doing it myself, how much they had to suffer and give to for me to exist. And so thinking then again about the kind of weight that we are all carrying in ourselves for anybody that we love, but that these roles that we play in each other's lives and how much goes unsaid in those roles.
That segment that you just read from that book where the young man is phoning home, and he's only a teenager. You know, he's a kid. He's working at this resort in Turkey and he's witnessed this drowning in the pool, and he calls his mom, desperately wanting her to step into a nurturing mother role. But instead, I think she flips it and says, you're stronger than you should be. And that really struck me as, I think as parents, we often do that. And then I remember as a daughter having that experience with my parents, you desperately want them to assume one role and they completely get that wrong, or they are imposing this other role that they should have. And that can lead to terrible heartache, but nobody ever really talks about that.
Right, exactly. And I wanted all of the characters to have lots of dimensions. So I wanted that mother to be kind of terrible. You feel, I think at moments, you kind of hate her and feel like, just be the mom. Somebody needs to be the mom here. And she won't do that. But then I also wanted her to be living the life that she really wants to be living, which is not something we usually afford to mothers. We want mothers to give everything. The job of a mother is to be completely selfless. If you look at all the Mother's Day cards, it was just Mother's Day, and I was looking at the cards in the store. It's like, it's all about having given your entire self and soul and all of your time over so completely. where the, you know, the Father's Day cards are like, hey, cool, let's sit on the couch for a little while. That's nice all you need to do all year.
Nice you could show up.
Exactly. Look at you. You know my name. That's amazing. So I wanted to bring that in, too, that she's saying, no, you know, I'm going to live the life that I want to live, too. And I'm going to give you the gift of trust that you're going to grow through all of these things and become the person that you need to be on your own.
She's pretty cool. She lets him go off as a teenager, right, to work in Turkey when he really wanted to go. It's not like she exiled him. He wanted to go traveling. He stole a boat so we could actually literally head off into sea. And she goes, well, maybe we can figure this out in a more in a safer way.
Right.
So she's a pretty cool mom as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that burden, or, you know, what's expected of mothers leads to another theme, I think, in the stories, which is about pregnancy? And there's ambivalence about pregnancy and how hard it is to get pregnant, or people find themselves pregnant maybe and it's not the opportune time. But that came up in so many different stories, you know, that these young women either trying to get pregnant or finding themselves pregnant. And, you know, I guess you said you went through pregnancy while you were writing these stories.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, it's miraculous and amazing and also really scary. And invisible, you don't know what's going on and don't know and have no idea what will unfold upon this baby's birth. It's quite a thing to literally have inside you and then to have to emerge and allow to become whatever it is, the relationship and the baby itself and all of that. So, and it can't be shared. The person who is experiencing the pregnancy is, even if they have a lovely support network, is doing that on her own. And I remember that feeling really strongly.
In the story Remedy, you have a couple, and both of them are orphans. And I was wondering if that, she's trying to get pregnant. She doesn't seem like the type who wants to get pregnant because there's so much other stuff going on. But at one point she checks, you know, she does a test and mm-hmm. she finds she's not pregnant. But she describes it as, that's the mutation expected in this part of life. Which seemed kind of a distant way to describe, but maybe realistic way to describe what it's like.
Well, I remember that when I had just gotten married, and I was in graduate school and I was writing these short stories, and everybody kept saying, so you'll have kids soon, right? And I felt like, what are you talking about? That is like, you're telling me this fantastical thing. Like you're saying like this science fictional thing can just happen to me. Where I don't know how to grow a baby. I don't know anything about that. But you're telling me that my body knows how to do that. And it did feel like a mutation. It felt like something that completely out of my known universe that could just happen. And that's the other thing about it that I find so fascinating is that it's entirely mundane. It's the first thing on nature's to-do list. It's really the only thing on nature's to-do list. We just have to reproduce. That's it. So it's the combination of this fantastical and miraculous and beautiful and just couldn't be more normal.
The mundane aspect of pregnancy, I thought, was just explored hilariously in one of the stories, Template for a Proclamation to Save the Species. And this small town mayor in some small town in Minnesota gets an idea from another equally cold and forlorn town in Russia to encourage women to have babies because that's going to cheer everybody up and save the species, or at least the small town economy, by offering a prize for somebody who can give birth on a specific day. And I found it hilarious, but also quite depressing that this was imposed upon the women of this town. And then, of course, nobody actually gets on the date at all. So it's like, well, I guess we'll give it to the person who came closest. But I just thought that was a really funny way to explore that idea.
Oh, thanks. That there was a real, the Russian town is real. And I found a newspaper clipping for that. This mayor in some little town off in the middle of Siberia was like, well, nobody's having babies. What if we give you a Lada and a refrigerator? And it's Lenin's birthday that you're supposed to give birth on in that town. And it, I clipped it and put it away for a long time. And I felt like I didn't know how to write it because I'm not Russian. So I wasn't going to write a story as the Russian mayor. But then I got the idea for an American mayor picking the same thing up and the sort of funny mutation of trying to institute this kind of Russian idea in an American town and in a Midwestern town, and the kind of misunderstandings in that. And then the way that the American women especially view the contest with a little bit of a side eye, like, aren't really, but the few of them take him up on it because you get a day off at exactly 9 months before this birth, hopeful birth date. Everybody gets a day off to stay home. He calls it love day. So
I like the teenagers, though, in order to rebel, they can't they can't couple in a way, right, because that's what they're expect. That's what everybody's expected to do on Love Day. So I thought that was a funny inversion there too, where you talked about the teenagers' reactions to things.
That was a fun part to write.
Yeah. So one of the things you have all these stories, and we've touched upon a lot of them. Do you feel you write novels as well? Do you feel that what do stories allow you to do or explore that you can't do in novels? I mean, is there something you think this is a story? There's no way this is going to be a novel, but I really want to dive into this.
I am never confused about which is a story idea and which is a novel idea. I hear some writers say they started it as a novel and then it turned out to be a story. That doesn't happen to me because I feel like the stories begin with some kind of conceit for me. Like, what if a Cyclops filled out an online dating profile? That's not a novel. You would lose interest in that. It's in fact not a very long short story. It's quite compact. What if in that story Remedy that you were talking about, Arson, the couple who are orphans, the woman feels like she's going to die. She's decided that one of them is going to die first and it's going to be her. And then her mind turns that into being that this is an imminent death. And so she concocts this plan that where they will trade hands. They will go to a far off destination and they will switch hands. And that could never be, again, a novel because I feel like you would get so deep into the weeds of explaining the technicalities and it would become much less interesting. Where in a short story, I can ask a reader to believe something big and I can explore a bunch of the tangly, interesting pieces of that and then leave you to think about it. And then I feel like the second half of the writing is done by the reader of just thinking about and considering these ideas themselves rather than having to follow it across a big, long plot arc like a novel.
Does it allow you to experiment more, try some of your wilder ideas?
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah. There was a collection. I mean, there was a story in my first collection called Tributaries about a town in which everybody grows a new arm every time they fall in love. And that was such a fun story to write. It made, you know, immediately, it's a great icebreaker if you're ever in a quiet bar and you want to find out how many love arms people think they would have. But it was like, it was so much fun to explore all the different kind of perversions of that without having to feel like I needed to be faithful to the large, big story of how this would actually technically work. So yes, there's wildness and exploration and magic in it. I love the short stories.
Mm-hmm. You have some characters that connect and the one where the mother's dissolving, where the one sister goes to Beirut and her sister is in that story, but she's kind of at a distance, isn't going to come see the mother. And then you get that sister's story. So there are connections. Do you think you would ever enlarge, like, want to experiment with doing a story collection that was more connected than this? This has themes in common, but it's not truly linked or connected.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's got, yeah, exactly. It's more connected in the sort of next layer, the ethereal world. I think it could be fun someday to do that. I don't have any particular plans for it, but I did really enjoy doing that at the end. I did all of that at the end because I'd written all the stories and then I kind of looked at them together because I wanted, like the title suggests, I wanted A Wayland to be a place, an actual landscape. So that the stories are in these little sections that describe some of the geography. And then it was fun to think about, well, if all these characters are living in A Wayland together, do some of them have relationships with one another and are the places in some way related too? So then I tried to kind of pull on some of those little connections and most of them are really subtle and no, you know, most readers won't notice and it doesn't matter. You don't need to notice them, but it was fun as the writer to draw those lines.
Are there any characters or stories that you would like to further explore and see what happened afterwards?
I don't know that there are. Not at the moment. You never know. Something might come back around, but for now I feel like they're all doing their jobs.
In the book, you really blend modern day, but ancient classics as well. I mean, you have the Cyclops, you have Camp Zeus, you have all the Greek gods. You have mermaids, which are, you know, it's a different branch of classic mythology. Was that something, do you have a background in the classics? Were these stories that you wanted to just dip into or just have them as characters in there?
I love all those old myths. I went to a Waldorf elementary school, so I didn't learn any history or anything normal. I learned all the Norse mythology and all the Greek mythology, and I learned how to knit, which I still do. So I think some of it was from sort of like those early memories of stories, and I read fairy tales as a kid too. And then when my husband and I got married, we went to Turkey and Greece for a few weeks for our honeymoon, and we listened to the Odyssey on the little, we had a little splitter for our headphones, and we would listen to chapters of it while riding on the ferry between different islands. And some of those islands were the islands that are in the stories, supposedly. And it was really fun to be in that place and to feel like the mythology was built into the landscape and that everybody was conversant in it. There was some kind of level of understanding of that long history that exists there and the way that history and the mythology interact with each other too, which we don't have that way in this country. And so I've always been interested in that and loved playing with it.
Were there any stories that didn't make it into the collection that you feel will appear somewhere, the New Yorker or another book?
There was one story that wasn't really finished yet and that I'll come back to later. And there was a story that the tiny little idea of it, I guess this sort of goes back to one of the things I was saying about the novel and story thing. There was one little piece of a story that got pulled out and is part of this novel that I'm working on now. So there was a little seed that I grabbed from there. But otherwise, I think it'll be new stuff as I go forward. We'll see.
You dedicate this book to your parents. And as we said, parenthood, pregnancy, relationship with mothers, those are themes that really loom large. Have you gotten any pushback from your parents about, hang on a second, did any of this happen in our family?
No, I think they know that it's all fictional. My parents have both been so supportive of my writing always and always there to help push me along and tell stories and offer up everything that they've got and very, very gentle and kind about the weird things that I'm handing them. So,
did you sometimes, like in the story, Do Not Save the Ferocious, Save the Tender, it's a really harsh opening, you know, with a sea captain and his daughter, and it's just, it makes you cringe. As a writer, do you cringe? Like, where is this coming from? Or I just got to go with it? Or how does a story like that develop for you?
Yes, that story does have a really upsetting beginning. And that story I started with, I just wanted to write something about that landscape. I really wanted to go to that, like, cold Scandinavian coastline. And it started more of the Viking kind of traits. And now you might still peg them to that, but it's not named. And I knew that it needed to start with a shipwreck so that they'd all nearly drown. Everybody falls into the sea and these three men survive. But I wanted it to be not an accident. I wanted there to be some malice in that drowning. So I wanted to put something there that was so awful that you felt like there was a reason that they deserved it in some way. Mm-hmm. And so that we begin not with characters who are heroes and beautiful and, you know, the glowing captain who saves everybody. No, I wanted to start with the opposite of that. The same way that I wanted the mermaid to not be the sparkling, beautiful, sexy mermaid that we all are used to. And I put that kind of misery there. And the thing is, I know what's going to happen. Usually, not always at the very beginning, but I know that I'm in control. So I know that I can kind of dial it back if it's too much for me. But I'm kind of comfortable with icky things. I'm not so comfortable with scary things. The scariness is harder for me to write because I don't love to hang out in that place. But like creepiness and discomfort and sadness, all that is, I'm like willing to throw it all in there.
Well, yeah. Well, in that story, you certainly feel the captain deserves to die. Maybe not the other two. But the thing, what I thought was interesting in that story, too, is there's a persistence of life. They end up on this coastline. It's utterly desolate. There doesn't seem to be any chance of rescue. One of them is hanging out with a whale carcass. You know, another goes down. You know, they're just not. One's making a weird maze, you know, every day. They're not. But there's a persistence of life. It's mm-hmm. like life just keeps going on. You know, you have that heartbroken, in another story, there's a heartbroken mother whose daughter has drowned in the ocean and whose husband went in after her, you know. But she persists. And now we meet her, I think, 37 years after the death or something. So there, in your stories, there is this persistent, like life will persist.
Yeah, well, that, which is... Jurassic Park had it right. Life will find a way. But there is this sort of, that's a hard truth in a way, that you can experience some kind of really tremendous tragedy and your body will not die because of it. You will have to keep living through the days and nights until something else happens. And time will change how you feel about the thing that happened and it will change you. And there is a sort of like tumbling of continuation that's both a beautiful gift, like you will continue, you will be okay, you will come to the other side of this in some way. And also that is its own kind of tragedy and a kind of suffering that you can't just, you will not decompose and disappear.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ramona Ossabel has been our guest at the Radio Book Club. Her collection of short stories is Wayland, and there's so much in this. It really is a wonderful collection. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you both.
We encourage you to tune into the After Hours at the Radio Book Club, a podcast only edition. For further conversation, we'll delve more into A Wayland and maybe hear more about Ramona Ossabel's travels that have maybe inspired this. Also, to let listeners know, After Hours at the Radio Book Club has just been recognised by the Public Radio News Directors Inc., Prindy Inc., their national awards, recognising the After Hours at the Radio Book Club podcast as one of their annual awards this year. So congratulations, Arsene.
Well, congratulations to you. I just sit here.
You just sit there. Well, you've also selected the stories, which is a major component. And to that end, in July, we're inviting people to read along with Rebecca Mackay and The Great Believers. Tell us about why you have selected that for our July read.
Well, Rebecca is one of my favorite writers. She's a great short story writer and novelist. And I feel like she's poised to become huge. You know, I think that she's going to become a household name at some point in her career. And this is her most ambitious novel to date. It takes place in a few different places, but it's about Chicago during the AIDS crisis. And she's a very strong writer. She writes with great detail. She writes great characters. I'm really looking forward to having her here.
Rebecca Mackay will join us July 26th at 9 a.m. In the meantime, you can subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club and the award-winning After Hours at the Radio Book Club wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. As always, my co-host. Thanks so much for listening.